these you're making these statements and that go against what you hear from other presumably people who know what they're talking about. So I would just say that in this case that people should go online and check out some of this stuff. Is this pandemic overblown? Are we are the vaccinations useless, or are they dangerous? Well, we have one listener saying so. So I think it's up to the listeners to check out these accusations and then come to your own conclusions. Because we're getting, I guess, very near the end of this show, and this is brought to you on KBOO, your radio station. We are always in need of funds and for input, and we are in need of volunteers to help keep this radio station on the air. So stay in touch, give us a call, give us your support. KBOO, your radio station.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Today on Sprouts, we feature an interview with journalist and author Carrie Gillum. This interview is part of the new radio production Heartland Stories. Brought to you by the folks that did Rootstock Radio, Heartland Stories is a weekly show featuring interviews about the future of food, farming, and public health. Listen now as host Teresa Marquez introduces Carrie Gillum.
I am Teresa Marquez, and I'm here today with Carrie Gillum. Carrie is a journalist and author of Whitewash. She's a Kansas girl, a courageous Kansas girl, because the story of the weed killer, cancer, and corruption of science in her new book, The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice, that will be published in March, is a courageous effort. Carrie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Teresa. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I was just remembering and listening to our 2018 interview. Wow, so much has happened in the last 3 years. And you are still an investigative journalist, activist, and author. What have you been up to for the last 3 years?
Oh, my goodness. Doesn't it seem like a long time ago,
2018? Sure does.
Back when the world was normal. So in 2018, I think when we spoke, my first book had just come out, Whitewash, as you mentioned. And the book did really well. I was really pleased with it. Won some awards and got a lot of attention from academics and universities around the world, actually. I spent a good deal of 2018 and 2019 traveling the world to speak about it. Many European countries were interested in what the book revealed about Monsanto and its glyphosate weed killers, Roundup and things, and how they could cause cancer, and how Monsanto had hidden the science and really hidden all of the harms from consumers for so long. So I vowed I'd never write another book. It sucked the life out of me, really. And then I wrote another book. So it's, that one comes out in March, as you said. And this one was really fun to write, and I do hope people will enjoy it. The first book was very much an academic sort of endeavor, very sciencey, very data-oriented. This book is the story of one man, Lee Johnson, and just such a lovely man and his family, hardworking, you know, rising, pulling himself up by the bootstraps kind of guy, and who comes down with a deadly cancer that he learns is due to his exposure to these pesticides that he was spraying. And sort of the book follows him through his battle with cancer and also his battle to hold Monsanto accountable for this, and the litigation and the trial and all of the sort of the legal maneuvering that went on behind the scenes. And it really is a fun read. I think it's gotten pretty good reviews and takes readers into the, you know, what goes on really in fighting cancer and also in trying to go through our court system. So I'm hoping people will enjoy that.
Yeah. So you've already got it out there for people reviewing it and reading it, and then it's actually going to be ready for the public in March. Is that right?
March 2nd. Yes.
You know, God, I think Lee Johnson, for those of us who have been following that, certainly has captured our hearts. What was it like, you know, like researching and talking and getting to know Lee Johnson?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time with Lee and his lovely wife and his two children and gotten to know him over the course of writing the book. And I've told him, and as I say in the book, I've come to admire him so much because he really faced a very daunting both diagnosis, being told that he was going to die very, very shortly, not live to see his two boys grow up, and then all that it took to go through the courtroom battle and all he's been through. And remarkably, here in 2021, he is still alive. He is still, you know, in a great deal of suffering with this very horrible cancer that he has. It's called mycosis fungoides, and it's essentially non-Hodgkin lymphoma that manifests in the tissue, in the skin. And so he has lesions, painful lesions and tumors that develop all over his body, you know, face, head, neck, legs, torso. You know, in one, just I'll never forget, he showed me one lesion on his foot that was just opened and was to the bone. And, you know, I cried when I saw it. But he just gets up every day and gets himself dressed and does his best to say, I'm not going to die today. And, you know, he's still out there kicking. And it's a moving story.
Kerry, you must have learned a ton of things while you were writing this book. Tell us about some of the things that, you know, really stand out for you as you were trying to put this together.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. What was really fascinating for me, so I've been a journalist since, you know, God knows, like forever, 30 years. And for the last 22 years or so, I've covered agriculture. So, you know, I know pesticides, I know agriculture, I know these big companies and that work in seeds and pesticides and food production and all of that. But I didn't know a lot about our court system and the mass tort, the way that mass torts are handled and toxic torts. Certainly as a journalist, I've covered a lot of court cases, but this one I really was able to get sort of behind the scenes and see the workings of these plaintiff's attorneys and how they maneuver and strategies and just all of the hoops that have to be jumped through and the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Can you stop for a second and make sure our listeners know what a mass tort is? It's not something that you bake.
No, very definitely not. So this is similar to a class action, but distinct from a class action. So mm-hmm. mass tort is where you have a lot of people who have been harmed, right, by a medical device or a product or, you know, someday, but the circumstances are different for every individual. So you're not going to really have a class action, but you are going to have what they call mass tort. So you have thousands, tens of thousands of plaintiffs. In this case, there are over 100,000 plaintiffs who have sued Monsanto, alleging that exposure to Roundup caused them to develop non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And these are state cases, federal cases that have been filed in federal court. And Lee Johnson was the very first to go to trial. So his case was very significant. There are a lot of people in Washington, D.C., a lot of companies that lobby against mass tort litigation. They want to rein this in. They want to rein in the ability of plaintiff's lawyers to bring these type of cases and to get big judgments. They want to rein in the ability of lawyers to hold corporations accountable when they sell products or you know, things that harm people. But really what I learned through this litigation, and maybe I already knew it, but this laid it bare ever more clearly, was that when our regulators and our lawmakers don't hold these companies accountable for harming people, these plaintiffs' attorneys really are the only outlet. They're the only avenue for justice. And, you know, it's really very compelling to see they put
millions of dollars of their own money on the line. They don't know if they lose, they don't get that money back. Nobody's paying them unless they win. And it's a really dramatic and powerful thing to watch unfold.
You know, I was remembering from Whitewash when you sued the EPA and got 8,000 pages from them that, you know, really disclosed an awful lot about the inner workings of Monsanto. Did you find that you were able to get a lot more information from when these cases came through? And I'm assuming that they, you know, also had a lot of disclosure during that case.
That's one of the really great things about litigation is this tool called discovery, right? That so the plaintiff's attorneys, the lawyers for Lee Johnson and the other plaintiffs, were able to demand that Monsanto turn over years and years and years of internal communications, internal emails and reports and notes and text messages even. And so it's from all of that information that this really explosive story comes to light of this company. You know, I knew and I laid out in Whitewash levels of deception, but the litigation laid bare so much more, really, really outrageous conduct, so outrageous, you know, that the juries in these three trials we've had so far awarded huge punitive damages. They found, you know, just outrageous malicious conduct on Monsanto's part. They awarded $250 million in punitive damages in Lee Johnson's case. They awarded $2 billion in punitive damages in a later trial of an elderly couple. So, yes, these documents that came out during litigation were just really, really important.
Well, you know, you talked about levels of deception. Can you give us an example about, you know, what kind of deception are we talking about here?
Yes, I mean, goodness. So Monsanto has said, and Monsanto is now owned by Bayer. We should say that Bayer AG, the large pharmaceutical life sciences company, bought Monsanto in June of 2018. And they now, you know, basically hold the liability for all of this. The Monsanto executives certainly knew when to get out, right? You know, their deception. So, for instance, Monsanto knew that the International Agency for Research on Cancer was going to look at this chemical glyphosate, which is the main ingredient in Roundup. Monsanto patented glyphosate in the 1970s and has relied very heavily on glyphosate in its products, you know, for all of these years, and has always promoted it as very safe, doesn't cause cancer, doesn't harm reproduction, doesn't, you know, do anything essentially to humans or animals. But when they found out that this International Cancer Agency was going to start looking at the science, we see in their internal documents they get very worried. And even though they're telling the public there's nothing to worry about, this doesn't cause cancer, internally they're saying we're very vulnerable. We know we're vulnerable with genotoxicity science and a lot of other sorts of science. And so we need to figure out a way to discredit these international cancer scientists. And we're going to put together a plan, and we're going to orchestrate outcry, and we're going to bring in third parties who look like they're independent of us to criticize this agency and to write all sorts of, you know, op-eds and blogs and things that will get posted in newspapers and on internet and all around. And we're going to make it all look like, you know, there is this grassroots outrage with these cancer scientists and that they are relying on junk science and that they are doing invalid science. Monsanto planned all of that internally. And what's noteworthy is they planned it all before the cancer scientists even took up glyphosate as a mission to determine and to classify it as to its carcinogenicity. So they knew what was going to come down. They planned a way to discredit these scientists, and then they put that plan into action after the cancer scientists indeed said, this looks like it causes cancer. And all the while they were telling the public, you know, it's fine, don't worry, the cancer scientists are crazy. Just one example of many where what they're saying publicly is very distinct and different from what they're planning and plotting and saying internally.
Here's an interesting thought I had while I was just reading through all this stuff, and that is that they lost. In fact, they lost more than just the Lee Johnson case, or I guess you could call it losing, in that they ended up having to, they basically had to pay out lots of millions of dollars, and you basically said another lawsuit where $2 billion maybe is involved. So here we are saying, wow, this corporation misbehaved, and we're fining them. Now, I started thinking about Citizens United, where corporations are individuals. If it was an individual, wouldn't they go to jail for that?
That is such a great point. And I was just speaking with someone the other day about this, and we were talking that the only way that we think there ever possibly can be change is when you start holding the executives at these companies accountable criminally, when their product is killing people, when there's evidence that they know that their product is killing people or injuring people, when there's evidence that it's dangerous and they continue to hide that and promote this product and sell it and not warn people, why should there not be criminal penalties for that? And if we did actually have that, maybe you would start to see improved corporate conduct. But, you know, I don't think we're anywhere near that. You know, the CEO of Bayer, who negotiated the acquisition of Monsanto, has been, you know, come under intense criticism and will be leaving. The company has been punished in the fact that its investors drove down share prices, and so its market capitalization, you know, took a huge hit in the billions of dollars of value they lost. The company has indeed suffered. The Monsanto executives, meanwhile, you know, have not. They were able to, after Bayer bought them, walk away with, you know, millions of dollars in their pockets and have done quite well. But Bayer as a company and the investors in Bayer are the ones who are essentially paying the price. And Bayer has now agreed to pay out around $11 billion in settlements to try to make this Roundup litigation go away. They did lose all three trials that were held to date. The amounts of money that were awarded have in fact been reduced by judges. The judges just couldn't wrap their heads around, you know, $2 billion in punitive damages. And so, but, you know, Lee Johnson has been paid. He took 2 years. He only finally got his money very recently. And it was a far cry from the total of $289 million the jury said he should have gotten. But he's been paid no amount of money, though, really. I mean, I talked to so many plaintiffs in this case. No amount of money addresses or makes up for all of the suffering that they go through with cancer.
You're listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. Today, you're listening to a show produced by Heartland Stories, a weekly radio show exploring food, farming, and public health. We return now to our interview with Kerry Gillum.
I'm fascinated, Kerry, as always, with the kind of learning that you're adding to. You have actually interviewed and know everything, it seems to me, about the food industry. And how has written this book expanded that broad learning that you have now of, you know, what the food industry is up to in the food corporations?
Well, I certainly would never say I know everything. I mean, you know, I am merely, you know, the transcriber, right, of what happens out in the world. And it is experts that I rely on, you know, people that you know quite well. You know, I was speaking with Marion Nessel, you know, this very gifted author and scholar, and Linda Birnbaum, just in the last couple of days, both of these women, Linda Birnbaum, one of the world's, you know, top epidemiologists who ran our National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences for many years. You know, it's these people, scientists and academics and farmers and people who really, I'm just trying to learn their stories, learn from them, and then put that together and share it with readers in a way that is meaningful. And I guess, as I said in my first book, and I'll say it now, I hold such a high regard for farmers. Everything I've learned over these last 20 some years of covering this industry, they are so essential, so critical. I used to think, you know, the financial markets and banks and that sort of thing, those were our most important corporations, our most important players. And I now think that farming, agriculture, is our very most important industry. So food is where it all begins. And we need to respect that and do everything we can to protect our food production system and to protect our environment and thereby the health of our children.
So fascinating that you're really talking a lot to farmers, but it's farmers who are keeping Bayer Monsanto alive. And if you talk to some of them, they'll say, those are our tools. We can't, quote, feed the world unless we have these tools. Are you talking to any of the farmers who have that point of view?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely I do. And, you know, I've become good friends with a farmer who lives fairly close to me here in Kansas, you know, who uses those tools, but, you know, is aware of the risks and, you know, tries his best to mitigate those risks. You know, and we just, you know, he says, we'll just agree to disagree, Carrie, but I'm never going to put myself in a position of trying to tell a farmer how to farm. I'll say that. But what I do see is an growing number of farmers around the Midwest, around the U.S., who are recognizing the damage that's being done to soil health and to water quality, right? And to biodiversity, to the microorganisms in the soil, to the nutrient value of the crops that they grow. They're recognizing that, and they're in it for the long haul, and they're looking to change their practices and move away from pesticide dependence and find a better way. And many, many are doing that. A movement that is steady and growing. And we all should support them. We should support government policies to encourage that type of movement. I know you have done a lot of that, obviously, in your career. So buying organic is one way to do that, I suppose. But there are a lot of other avenues out there, and people just need to educate themselves and be informed and, you know, seek out your local farmer if you're able to.
Well, you know, all of that is super good, and, you know, it's such great advice, but I feel calcified. For example, in Wisconsin here, we lost 800 family farmers in 2020, They went to CAFOs, who are just perpetuating this pesticide treadmill. What do you think out there? You say people are changing. What are you seeing that's working?
Well, I've written a little bit about the idea of Farm Network. I don't know if people are familiar with that. I think that's just such a great example. A group of farmers who come together, they, you know, started in Illinois, and it spread in Illinois and Kansas and Missouri and Nebraska and all around. And they're really working together, and they've gotten some grant money. They're developing tools for sharing, you know, their information through videos, as well as getting together, and they blog and they have listservs, but they really drill down and, you know, all right, here's techniques that are going to work for growing corn without pesticides, and, you know, row spacing and the type of cover crops to use, and the type of crop rotation, really drilling down to see their goal is to meet or beat the yields associated with conventional farming that uses pesticides. And they're documenting it, and they're bringing more and more farmers into the fold, and they're seeing really, you know, positive results. So, I mean, that's just one example. I think what we do need, you're right, though. I mean, we need profound change in our policies in Washington, D.C., and we need people coming in who recognize that. I'm not sure Vilsack, you know, is the person to run our USDA if we're looking for real change and overhaul. We can be hopeful with the Biden administration. It certainly can't be any worse than the Trump administration, which seemed designed to just hand over the, you know, the keys to the big chemical companies. So I don't know. I feel your you know, pain, and I guess I share the dismay, but I also just want to be hopeful that change can really happen.
I started out this interview by calling you courageous because, wow, you were talking about Lee Johnson being David to Goliath. You seem to me to also be Carrie against Goliath. Isn't it difficult and also sometimes scary to think that you're taking on one of the biggest corporations in the world?
There was one sort of period when I felt fear, I suppose. I felt a lot of frustration over the years, I can tell you that. And I certainly didn't set out to take on Monsanto. I mean, as a journalist, you don't do that necessarily. I mean, what I've sought to do is, you know, tell truthful information about a very big and powerful company, many companies and many practices and policies. So as a journalist, you get used to companies pushing back and trying to control and influence the stories that you write. Certainly Monsanto, it became clear over my years of covering Monsanto that they were the king of this, right? They they did this more than anybody else. And I didn't know for many years that they, you know, the lengths that they were going to discredit me. We've since found out through internal documents that came out through the Monsanto Roundup litigation. That they, you know, are very strategic, and that they hire consulting groups and PR groups, and you know, pay money to third parties to so it doesn't look like the criticism is coming from them. So it looks like it's coming from other people. But yeah, they attacked me. They sought to ruin my career, harass me. They did it to the nonprofit I work for now, U.S. Right to Know. They've done it to many other people. I think we've just scratched the surface with the internal documents that we've gotten. But, you know, it did cause me some sleepless nights and caused me, you know, a little bit of anxiety over time, but certainly never made me want to stop reporting on them. Probably the opposite.
It inspired you to continue to report on them.
I think I've said this before, but people who know me know, you know, if you try to tell me to sit down, you try to tell me to be quiet, it just makes me want to stand up and be louder. I mean, it just is part of my personality. So I might be better off if I had chosen to move away from this line of work and do something different, as Monsanto very much wanted me to do. I mean, there's an internal document that, you know, where they talk about really wanting to make me go away.
Is this the Project Spruce document?
Project Spruce, there's a spreadsheet that came out from Monsanto, was internal, that was able, we were able to see, came out through litigation, that a spreadsheet that basically was talking about my book before it came out, and how they wanted to discredit the book and all the different things that they were going to do. And there was a reference to that as being part of Project Spruce. So, you know, it's all very covert. They employed, you know, a dozen or so Monsanto employees, and as I said, brought in two different public relations firms and then different front groups, all to try to discredit me and discredit U.S. Right to Know and different people. So,
well, you know, you probably had the experience after Whitewash in that book, and I hope that our listeners all check it out. It's a good book to read. To get grounded into, you know, what corporations can do when they have the money and want to sway your opinion on things. But weren't there lots of examples in there about other people being discredited and having it documented in emails? So you weren't surprised, were you, when you saw that they were doing something similar with you?
I guess I wasn't necessarily surprised, although I was surprised at the level of detail and effort that they put into this. You know, I'm one little person. I'm one little woman who lives in Kansas and writes books and writes articles, you know, about agriculture. And for them to put so much time and energy and effort and a whole spreadsheet, you know, about how to work with all these different groups to discredit me and discredit my book, that was impressive to me. I thought, gosh, if they're going to do this to me, Lord knows what they're doing to all these other scientists and other writers. You know, we found that they have a fusion, what they call a fusion center, an intelligence and fusion center, that really focuses on how to harass, intimidate, and discredit people who are reporters or scientists or others. So if you've got a fusion center designed to discredit people, you know that you're not up to good, it doesn't sound like.
Can you give us a website that our listeners might like to go to if they want to learn more about your books?
Yeah, so carriegillam.com, CareyGillam.com. U.S. Right to Know is, I also have a lot of work there where I work now, usrtk.org. And, you know, the Heartland Health Research, there's so much good information there. So Heartland Health Research Alliance, where you guys have your radio show, and there's so much really, really good scientific information there, I think.
Thank you so much, Carrie, and just good luck with all the work that you're doing and also with the release of your book. Once again, I'm hoping it's going to be a smash.
Thank you. Me too. Thank you so much.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Heartland Stories interview with Cary Gillum. Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's URSULA at pacifica.org. This week's producer was yours truly, Charlie Knorr. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community